Mina, we're going to go back a little bit now and start digging into some of the things you said. I'm interested in hearing more about your grandparents and their involvement with Judaism. I know you said you have very fond memories of going to shul with your grandfather in Oakland.
I can't think of the name of the shul, but it was a very Orthodox synagogue where, as I said, the women sat separate from the men. And but you could, as a little girl, I could go up to the bima, which was in the center of this old shul. It's still there. It's on Ward Street. I could get the name for you if I rode past one day. But it was a very important part of my grandfather's life. And because I lived on Juliet Street, I could just walk with him to it. And that was important, to walk and hold his hand and go, you know, go with him there. I didn't understand a thing that was being said. Just thought it was wonderful, all these men davening and bending their heads and their long tallises. Maybe that was what makes my aversion to seeing tallises, because I always thought they looked so dirty. They were old, and they were yellowed, and they looked dirty, and I don't like that kind of thing. And I don't particularly care for yarmulkes. Now, our new rabbi at Rosh Hashanah, a cute young man, Peter Stein, is wearing a yarmulke. And I think what I mind about it is that this is this teeny little round thing, and it sits on the back of his head, and he's got these clips stuck in it. It bothers me. It bothers me. But I have to get used to everything. And so I take it with a grain of salt, just as I did the tallises. I saw no need for those at all at Rosh Hashanah. And the young rabbis who came, Debbie Pine and Andy Bush, brought that. And I guess Walter took it on, and so did Mark Stateman, and so now it's there. I just don't think they're particularly, I don't think it does anything for me. It doesn't do anything for me, because what we are doing with Reform Judaism, going back to the way it was in the olden days, that was offensive to me. Seen that on my grandfather, because he had this long enshrouded thing with these long fringes that, because you kept fingering them, holding them in your hand, running them through your fingers like Catholics do with the catechism on their crosses, I was offended by that, because they were dirty. To me, that was a sign of uncleanliness, and I don't like that. And I think it's one of the things I find offensive many times with Orthodox Jews who have the tzitzis falling out of their clothing. It strikes me they're not very clean. And they might be clean as can be, but that, if you're wearing something close to your body that isn't clean like that, and you can't clean them, you're not supposed to be allowed to clean them, so that to me is offensive, and I don't really see the need for it in our temple. Mm-hmm. However, it's being done over and over and over again. Now that I see Peter Stein coming with the little yarmulke on, I don't know about Rabbi Gibson. Does he wear a tallis now?
No, not a tallis, but a yarmulke. Kippah.
Okay.
How did you feel about the men and women being separated when you went to shul with your grandfather?
Oh, that was very disturbing to me, always. That's why I joined a Reform congregation. I did not like that at all. Now, as opposed to Tree of Life, the difference was that I had a great many friends who were members of Rosh Hashanah, and when Victor and I married, Rabbi Halpern married us, and he was the rabbi at Tree of Life Synagogue, but we didn't join immediately a congregation, because there was no need to in those days. Until you had children, you really didn't. But we were married in 1950, and in 1951, they asked Victor, Sunday school at Rosh Hashanah on Sundays. And that, but we had Sunday school both Saturday and Sunday. And because he was, and we went to a lot of different things, which we were allowed to go to, because he was affiliated as a teacher, and then I began teaching at Rosh Hashanah, but they asked Victor, after the second year that we were married, to become the assistant executive director of Rosh Hashanah Temple, and he was an assistant to Chester Bandman, who was the executive director for a great many years also. And Victor, just when Chester retired, Victor became the rabbi. Well, the minute that Victor began to teach at Rosh Hashanah, it was incumbent upon us to join. And so we joined Rosh Hashanah, and then Victor became the assistant executive director. And so that's the reason that I went in the direction of reform, but I would have anyway, since a great many of our friends were members of Rosh Hashanah, and so that would have been the natural thing to do. We just joined it earlier than most of our friends who didn't join until they were married and had children who were going to Sunday school. And that seems to be the pattern still, although I must say that Rosh Hashanah has a wonderfully active junior congregation, and those junior congregation people joined when they were not even married, in many instances.
Did your parents attend shul with your grandfather as well?
Well, they would walk over for high holidays. They were not regular shul goers like my grandmother and grandfather were. My grandmother went with my grandfather and just took me along, and my brother, and my cousin Jack when he was around. He eventually moved from Joe Hammer Square, his mother and father and he, to one of the three floors. We were on the third floor, my grandparents were on the second floor, and my cousin Jack and his mother, Shirley Julius, and Harry Julius, lived on the first floor.
Mm-hmm.
So again, there was all kinds of family that you could have around you, and you knew that your family was close. It's one of the things I think has caused young men and young women to just find other mates because they're no longer really close to a close-knit society. They don't have their parents nearby as we did in our day. And that was nice.
Describe the apartment as you remember it and tell us a little bit about your home life when you were very young.
Well, because we lived from a very early age on on the third floor of the three-story house that my grandparents owned, it wasn't huge. It had two bedrooms and a living room with the dining room combined, and a kitchen. And, of course, one bath. In those days, you didn't have to. And actually, it wasn't really a separate bedroom. It was a large, huge bedroom that had an alcove where my brother and I shared the same bed that in those days. And then by the age of, I'd say, 10, we moved from there to McKee Place. And were within walking distance of where my grandparents lived, and then stayed there until I was married. I went to Pitt from McKee Place, actually. Lived in an apartment on McKee Place.
Would you?
But that time, growing up young, of course, I was always there when my grandparents were always around me. They watched me. They could take care of me. When my father was on the road selling, then my mother was just alone, and she was a marvelous card player, and she used to deal for poker games at the Hungarian Club on Murray Avenue. There was a very active Hungarian Club, and she she was a marvelous card player, bridge, gin, and poker.
Your parents' financial well-being, do you have any recollection?
It was excellent when my mother and father were married, before I was born, and shortly after I was born, that was when they owned the cigar and candy factory. But then when it went by the way, my father then went on the road as a salesman, and times were not good at all. And my mother, as I said, was very good at earning money through playing cards. She was skilled at it. And that's how I went to college, because I gave up the offer of a scholarship because I felt that there were people who couldn't afford it at all, where my mother could afford to send me to the University of Pittsburgh. It wasn't anywhere near what it is now, and as little as it is now, and still was not. And I lived at home, mm-hmm. and could go to things very close. I could walk to the University mm-hmm. of Pittsburgh. It was not, I didn't need a car, and didn't own a car until Victor and I were married a few years. And then my father taught me, plus I went to a driving school, so I didn't have a car for the first, we were married for 5 years, and I rode the streetcars to where I taught school. And I taught at A. Leo Wow, and I went on the 7754 in one direction. And when I left A. Leo Wow, I went to Lincoln Elementary. And I was at Lincoln Elementary for a couple of years before we bought a car.
What was your background in religious studies and in Hebrew?
Very little in Hebrew, just what I could do to get through Hebrew school, and not really a really good knowledge of it. I do most of the prayers, and we do a lot of Hebrew now at Rosh Hashanah. I do most of them by rote. I can pick out some words that I remember from Hebrew school, but very little. I'm not, I guess if I didn't go as often, I wouldn't be very happy at all with how much more Hebrew we're doing. I love singing the songs in Hebrew, but that's the melody, and I love music, and that I learned by rote too. And when I taught at Sunday school for 25 years at Rosh Hashanah, I learned all of the songs that we sing at the end of the service. But truthfully, all that we sing during the service, many of my friends who don't come as often are really annoyed the one or two times they do come, that there's so much Hebrew in the service, and it has come that way. Do I have a desire to learn Hebrew and become bat mitzvah? No, not really. Not really. I feel my religion very deeply through the deeds I do, and through attending services and being a part of Rosh Hashanah, doing an active part. I was always at sisterhood board meetings until I got this full-time job again. I wasn't always. For a couple of years there, where before Victor died, I was active and never missed the board meeting unless I was out of town, and that could happen because we traveled mm-hmm. extensively. But I feel that's not important.
Mm-hmm.
It just isn't.
Where did you attend religious school?
To Tree of Life.
Okay.
I went to Tree of Life. I was confirmed from Tree of Life, but did not go through a bar mitzvah, bat mitzvah, because that wasn't done in those days.
Mm-hmm. Now, you just touched on something that was interesting. What is your sense of being Jewish? You just mentioned something to that effect.
The way I live. I live the golden rule. and I try to practice it. I want to do to others what I would hope they would do unto me. It isn't always done, but I feel a very deep sense of I have certain things I want to be able to give other people who don't have as much as I do something. And if I can do it through service in the community, not just the Jewish community, I try to serve my community other ways too. And I used to be very active in United Way, and I am still a judge of elections for my district, not this district, but I'm still over in the Squirrel Hill district, and I feel very deeply about serving in your community. I am very actively, or was very actively involved with Danny Cohn's campaign, not just because he's a Jew, but he's a personal friend. And I feel we need people in government who are good. Cyril Wecht is my intimate friend. As I said, he's my children's Uncle Cyril, and I'm godparent to three of his children, and the fourth one I'm not. But truthfully, I feel very dedicated to this Pittsburgh community, and I would like to be influential in other ways, but you are bound, I think, inhibited by not having money.
Mm-hmm.
And I say that very honestly. I probably would have been the president of Women's Division of UJF, and I'm not mincing words when I tell it to you in all honesty. I was told by the man who was then the UJF chairman, chairman of UJF, you need to have money to have that prestigious position. And there's no doubt, as a school teacher and the wife of an executive director at Road of Sholem Temple, they did not pay a great deal, and Victor never left here because I wouldn't leave. I really needed to be near my mother. I felt it was important to her to have me. He got wonderful job opportunities that would have paid him a hell of a lot more money, and consequently, he'd have had a better pension. And that, too, is a bone of contention, but there's nothing you can do about it. And so I tried to do the best with what I could. I held two jobs my entire life, and so did Victor. Victor taught at the University of Pittsburgh and at Carnegie Mellon for a lot of years while he was the executive director of Road of Sholem. And I tutored, many years I tutored UJF for College Board students. I made more money than I did teaching school for the Pittsburgh Public Schools. And you know our salary is and was better than most some positions, probably better than your position at UJF.
Probably.
When you think about it. I mean, teachers do very well now. And for a lot of years, I was at the top of my salary, had a master's degree, and a number of credits towards my doctorate. So I was up there, but with it, I still, many years, tutoring the students after school, Saturdays and Sundays, I made more money than I did. So it was two jobs that I held down, so I could afford for my children the kinds of things, taking them to Europe, going to Israel a number of times, those kinds of things that they wouldn't have had. Taking them skiing, taking them to Beach Haven. Those are things that Victor and I could provide for them that they wouldn't have had under ordinary circumstances. So I understood. It was disappointing because I was a vice president of UJF Women's Division. And to know that I could be the next president, but wasn't allowed because I wasn't giving in that kind of category and can't. I just cannot do that. Many years I gave much more than what anyone in my circumstances would have given. But again, I did that because I was taking money from my second job, which was tutoring.
How did that make you feel
in
terms
of
everything
you
did in the community?
At the time, very hurtful. I grew to learn that you have to understand that money is going to beget money, and if I'm not able to give in that category, how could I expect my workers to go out and do that? And even now, how can I be a campaign person calling people, asking them to give in the $5,000, $2,000 category? I do it now because I work very actively with the telethons, and there you have cards and you do what you do. But in that bracket, I'm in the bracket that's only $1,000. Well, how can I do that without giving myself? It's very hard to approach people and say, but in my circumstance, I know that they can afford more, so I am pitching them because I know that they could give more. But to be the president of UJF Women's Division, and at the same time that I was vice president of Women's Division, I was the president of National Council of Jewish Women. So one sort of offset the other. Harriet Levinson said to me at the time, and what a lovely woman she was, and is, she is, but she lives in Florida now. But she was a president of the Women's Division before. And when she sat talking to me, she said, Mina, you take the presidency of National Council of Jewish Women. They do, I was a vice president there too, and she said, they do the work that I wish UJF women could be doing. They're the doing women in the community, and for years that's true. That's the way it's always been. I joined that organization as my maybe second year married. And so she said, do that because you're never going to be made the president of Women's Division. It won't happen.
Right there.
You don't give enough. And they need somebody who does give.
They're very distinct in personalities, the two, and each has a place in the community.
Yes, it does. It is a little bothersome, and there are a number of my friends who mind it.
Mm-hmm.
They also dislike that, too. Like a Susie Wolf, for instance, mm-hmm. could very well have been made the president of Women's Division, but she wasn't giving in that category. At the time, she didn't have that kind of money. Maybe now, but now she gets opposed to things like that. There are lots of people who are really opposed. I'm sure that you've come up against it in your position. You are aware of it, but it is something that you have to face. And I consider myself bright enough to realize you have to understand your limitations. And if you don't have that kind of money, I think always, oh, wouldn't it be wonderful if I won the lottery? Then I could give all the money out that I want to give out. Because you don't need all of that you're going to win if you were going to win a lottery. Well, I don't play the lottery, so how can I win the lottery? But, I mean, I'm not a gambler of any kind like that.
Your children grew up seeing you and your husband doing this. How are they in volunteerism and philanthropy?
If they had stayed closer to Pittsburgh and lived near me longer, I probably would have been as involved, maybe not, because I'm a unique person that way. But my kids really thought I did much too much, and so did my mother. She used to think that I didn't, but I have a lot of energy, which people don't really realize, and I am a night person. Now I go to bed by midnight, and I'm up at 5:30 every morning, and I don't really get enough sleep, but for me, it's probably enough. I yawn a lot, and I don't like doing that to people, and I tend to fall off some time or another if I'm listening to music, or when I was at the symphony, I would probably fall asleep at some passage and then wake myself up. But that happens because I really don't get enough sleep. But I do have a lot of energy, and I can stay up late. Then I I now, as I said, I tend to try very hard to be asleep by 12 midnight, or I know that it's going to be a very rough day. Yet, if it happens that I'm up till 1, I can see that it doesn't throw me. Maybe I yawn more that day. However, they probably were a little turned off by a tremendous amount of the giving. They do contribute to their high school, drawn to Shadyside and Marty to Winchester Thurston. Minimal, but they do contribute to that. And I would say if they were asked by their UJF in the various places they are, if they were known on the rolls, so to speak, they would give. Because they know that their parents did, not just me, Victor did too. And Victor and I both were much too generous. My accountant always says, "My God, don't you end up ever? You give to everything." Well, that's my nature, and that I don't know that that's their nature. I wouldn't honestly say that they would be that way. Now, when they would join in their temple, Marty is generous to her temple. I mean, she contributes to whatever there is that's going on. And she says that in the Westport area, they are forever asking. And that's one of the things she minds about her synagogue and about her temple. She probably, once her son is bar mitzvahed, or maybe once her daughter is out of the temple talks thing that she goes to, it's possible that she'll join a smaller congregation that she feels is not so greedy. Mm-hmm. This is a big Reformed temple in Westport, right, and you know what that tends to be like, just as it is in Westchester, I'm sure. New York and Connecticut are a world unto their own, and they are always asking for money for something or another. So she does do that. But does she give to UJF? I bet you they haven't even approached her in her community. Does she go and say, "I want to give money"? No. No. But John, if he does enter a synagogue, a temple, if he joins one, and she is not, she'll go with him. She doesn't say anything about not. She reads books that I didn't buy her. She herself bought. So if they joined a temple, eventually, I believe John would be as generous as he knows his mother to be. He contributed to the plaque that we gave in Victor's memory. It's $10,000. And he had given enough, $4,000, to put a one line in the book that we have sitting in the temple. And that was on his own at the time. But when Victor died, then we all together just did the 6,000 more and have a plaque on the wall. Now, he would do that in his own temple, I feel fairly certain, mm-hmm, because he knows it's the right thing to do. And once they know who he is in that Jewish temple, then UJF, or whatever they call it in Boston, Federation, their Federation, whatever it's called, a Greater Boston Federation, I think it's called, he probably then would get involved in that. When he lived here for the year and a half that I think you knew him, there was a year and a half, a couple of years ago, that he was back here. It was a year and a half before Victor died. And he came here to work with Gruntel here in Pittsburgh because he thought he'd like to return to Pittsburgh where the living is cheaper. But this Gruntel office was very small. His office, in his stockbroker office, had 80 men. This had 7. And it was a very big difference in the way they did business. And they didn't like the way he did business, and he didn't like them at all. So after a year and a half, after Victor died, in May, Victor died in 1997, and 3 years, or 1997, January, yeah. No, 1996.
Right, because I met you, he had already passed away.
Had he?
Yes. Okay. I started there in 96.
You did. Okay. But he died in January 17th, 1996. It's 3.5 years. That's mm-hmm. right, 1996. John was here for a year and a half, and it's almost as if God said to him, go home because your father isn't going to live long. He didn't know that at the time, but it was a wonderful year and a half that we had with him here living in mm-hmm. Pittsburgh. And then he went to UJF, and he got affiliated. That's how he met the girl that he was engaged to, because he went to a noon meeting at Jeffrey Spear's office, mm-hmm. and they were talking about how to get speakers to come at noon, and the girl he was engaged to was a lawyer, and he met her through that. So he was doing things for UJF then that...